Okay, folks, well, this is the hour. This is Dr. Keith Scott-Mumby. This is my reading room. We're doing diet-wise, and if you've been here before, you'll know where we're up to. If you're just joining us, you won't, so I'll tell you that we've looked at general principles of dieting and also how to do a decent exclusion diet, what the options are. I mean, the most extreme option is just the fast, and then all the way through a spectrum, a whole spectrum of possibilities to what's a fairly comprehensive exclusion diet, the so-called Stone Age diet or caveman diet, where you can eat plenty of stuff and still with a very good chance of an excellent and positive result. So we then move on to the next question, which is what to do from that point. Each of those diet programs, by the way, has a different time scale. If you're going to do a fast, you usually get an answer within 5 days, you know, 7 days at the most. If nothing's happened in that time, then it's not going to happen. And similarly, if you do the so-called eight foods diet, you would generally get an answer in 7 to 10 days maximum. If you do the Stone Age or caveman exclusion diet, you're looking at 10 to 14 days. But once again, if there's no result in 14 days, there probably isn't going to be one. The only exception is a person who's severely constipated. If the bowel isn't cleared of the food, then you don't get the result. So if you know that you're in that condition, you may need to run a little longer. And also, of course, you may need to do something about the plumbing. I suggest something simple like Epsom salts, magnesium sulfate is a very mild laxative. Senna pods as an infusion would be okay, but no fancy laxatives because you never know what's in those. And if all else fails, a glycerin suppository or two. All of these things will generally get a stubborn bowel moving. So apart from that exception, though, you know, extremely slow bowel transit time, apart from that exception, most of these diets will deliver in the time scale I suggested. So whichever you've picked, there will come a time when you think you want to start. You know, you've got a result one way or the other. Now, I can only think of three results. If anyone can come up with another one, let me know. The only three I know is that on an exclusion program, you'll either feel better, you'll feel worse, or you won't feel any different. And each one has its own significance, but whichever you decide, you know, if you've gone on long enough and you've got a decision that maybe you're worse, or you've got a decision it isn't changing, but at some point you're going to have to start reintroducing foods no matter what happens. Well, I'm going to start with the scenario where it was good. You know, you went on an exclusion program and you felt really good. So that makes things easy. We'll deal with that one first. And what you have to do is what we call a challenge test. Now, it's important to understand there is no absolute test for a food allergy or a food intolerance. I think I said this last week. You know, the best test we've got, possibly, is an exclusion and challenge diet if it's done properly. But, you know, if you don't do it properly, it doesn't mean very much anyway. It's no good saying, well, let's do a blood test and then we'll find out for sure, because the blood tests are actually very unreliable in this arena. I used to do a special, rather amazing kind of intradermal testing called Miller's Method after Dr. Miller, who developed it. Well, it was actually developed by a doctor called Carlton Lee, but unfortunately, or a bit unfairly, Joe Miller's name got attached to it because Joe Miller wrote the book, even though he didn't discover it. So if you want to be really finicky, it's the Carlton Lee Method, and it's a method of giving intradermal shots that are likely to provoke symptoms. It's very different to scratch and prick tests. That was quite a good way forward, too, and a good strong pointer, but again, not 100%. You know, you had to combine all your evidence. But as a layperson, short of sending blood away for a cytotoxic test, you don't really have lab tests to back you up anyway. So you simply have to do a very careful exclusion and challenge program, and I can say that 95% of the time, it'll come out with good answers that you'll find helpful and workable. That's why I wrote the book. And, you know, there's as much as you need to know in there. If you get completely stumped, then there are professional people that can help you. But if you're on your own, as I said, you need to reintroduce things. And as I said last week, you don't just go for the, you know, the things you're missing. Oh, my God, at last I can have a cup of coffee, or, you know, that sort of feeling. Very tempting, but it's absolutely the wrong thing to do. What you want to do is, first of all, introduce some foods that are probably okay. And that way you'll build up your repertoire of foods and leave the bad foods until last. The reason is, you know, if you, let's say you're down a glass of milk and feel really crummy, you might feel crummy for 2 or 3 days, and it means you can't do anything else until the milk has cleared from your bowel and the symptoms have gone again. So it's just kind of wasting time. You know, it'd be better to introduce things that are probably okay and then look at the troublemakers. But whichever sequence you, that's the intelligent way to do it, but whichever sequence you pick, you have to do the challenge test correctly. The fundamental rule, you've already met the requirements, and the fundamental rule is you must have been off the food strictly and totally for a minimum of 5 days. Well, a minimum of 4 days, but 5 days is safer. And it all has to do with that bowel transit time thing I was telling you about. So long as the food is clearly gone from the body, then there's a very strong chance that the symptom will show up right then when you first eat it. Sometimes it can be astonishingly strong, and the person is really quite amazed and astonished just that they ate it every day and didn't notice anything, and yet when you exclude and challenge it, it produces a very severe symptom. But it isn't always like that. Sometimes you only get a sort of mild warning. You know, you eat the food, you've been off the food, you feel good, you have a dose of the food, and you just kind of feel just a little bit yucky. You know, it doesn't have to be bad, but it definitely doesn't feel right. Well, you take that as a warning sign anyway, because it means if you go on eating it, that will build up, that kind of yuckiness will gradually build up again until you just feel ill and you're back where you started. So you must take note of all symptoms, no matter how minor. Anyway, this is how we do a full challenge test. This is my sort of proprietary approach, as it were, that I found is very helpful indeed. It's a combination of what I know and learned with what Arthur Coker used to teach. Arthur Coker is a great physician from the 50s who wrote a book called The Pulse Test. And his premise was, and a very good one indeed, that you can detect an allergy or a food intolerance because it will alter your pulse. Not everything does when you eat it, but if you eat a food and your pulse accelerates, that's a pretty strong pointer to the fact that that food isn't good for you. Logical, if you think about it, it means it's a stressor. If it accelerates the pulse, it's stressing the body in some way. Okay, so these are my recommended challenge test procedures. First of all, if you can, test only on a day when you feel well. Well, you know, if you felt worse, that we'll come to different instructions, but we're taking the best case scenario first, which is that you do feel good. You know, most of your symptoms are gone. You feel great. So that's easy. That makes it easy to spot when something's happening. Because if you've already got a symptom, you know, you've already got a headache and you're looking for causes of migraine, you might just miss something. I'm sure you can understand that. It's just totally logical. You might make things worse, so you still get your signal, but you might not. Now, this is what I have people do. First of all, I think the best test comes at lunchtime. We make that the main test meal. If you try and test at breakfast time, you often suffer from that early morning thing that we get, you know, just not feeling quite together and you're still sleepy and not quite with it, not really quite self-aware or as self-aware as you should be or would like to be. So lunchtime is better because however you feel when you wake in the morning, by lunchtime you're generally back to feeling reasonably normal. On the other hand, using the evening meal is not a good place to go either, because you may get a reaction several hours later, and it could be when you're asleep. You might miss it. So lunch, for various reasons, we pick lunch, and those are the most important reasons. In fact, you can repeat the dose. Well, you have a test dose at lunchtime. You can repeat it with the evening meal, by all means. But make the first test meal your lunch, and if you, at all humanly possible, try to make the food that you're testing the only food in the meal. Now, I know it can be extremely tedious. You know, if you think in terms of, say, rice, you know, just munching your way through a bowl of rice. Because you could put salt with it, but you wouldn't be able to have anything else fancy. That's a rather tedious meal, but I repeat what I said last week about this approach, which is this is not eating for pleasure. This is eating for health. This is a discovery and a detective process. So even if it bores you to death, you just need to do it. Then when you've got the answer, then you can dress up, let's say, rice. Once you've found that you can eat rice and it's safe, then you can dress it up in every way you can think of, you know, and have curries with rice and stew and all those kind of things, rice milk. But be prepared to be exceedingly bored on your test meal, please. You need to make up a fairly decent portion. You know, if you're going to test apple, say, I wouldn't eat one. I'd eat at least two. Three might be a lot, might give anybody bellyache, but if you at least have a substantial dose, you see what I'm saying? You know, if you're going to test milk, there's no point having a couple of ounces. You want to drink a pint, if you can get it down without retching. If you start to retch, then, of course, that's a very good clue in its own right that it's really not tolerated. You see, we want, excuse me, the whole point is that we want to push this. We want to really try and force a reaction if there's going to be one. If you take a small dose and get away with it, you may be serving yourself very badly. You think, ah, that's okay. But you didn't really have much. And it wasn't okay. So, you know, 2 or 3 weeks down the line when you're back to eating fuller quantities, then you're back in trouble. So to be considered safe at this stage, a food has to pass a pretty substantial push. And the first part of the push is to have great dollops of it at lunchtime. You then before you do that, you need to take a resting pulse. Now, resting means you've been sat still, you haven't been walking around, doing housework or anything else for at least 2 minutes, so that it calms down to, you know, what it really should be. You of course, accelerate your pulse if you're active. But if you sit still for 2 minutes, then you'll have what's your real pulse rate at that moment. Take a measure, and I found that with lay people, it's not good enough to just take 15 seconds and multiply by 4 like nurses do. They do it every day, and they're quite good and quite accurate. Count for the full minute, then you've got a fair amount of accuracy. Or in other words, it's 4 times more accurate than the way the nurses do it. And that's your basic, your resting pulse rate before you start. You then eat the food, and then you just simply, you have to give yourself enough time to observe yourself. In my experience, most of the reaction takes place in the first 2 or 3 minutes. There's something will happen then and there, right when you do it. You feel a bit of a funny head or a bellyache or just in some way something that's not quite right. You don't need to wait for a full-blown headache and lying on the sofa groaning hours later. That you can see it in those first few minutes if you're alert. Anyway, whenever it happens, if it does happen, that's a sign it's a bad food and you leave it. If nothing happens, so far as you were aware, nothing happened. You take your pulse again about 30 minutes and about 60 minutes after that test meal. If it goes up, that's a significant sign, especially if it goes up 10 or more beats. If it just went up 3 or 4, we're not too interested. But if it goes up by 10 or more beats, it means it definitely is a stressor food. And my advice is to set that aside anyway and come back to it later and do it, you know, a week later. Try it again and see if you get the same kind of marginal reaction. But if there's no symptom, no pulse change, as far as you were aware, nothing happened and it seemed to be okay, then you just go back to a normal evening meal, but try to include, you know, plan it so that you can include more of the evening meal, with the evening meal, I should say. So if it was rice, you know, have a curry or a meat stew or something that you can serve up with rice so you get another helping. And again, observe yourself. There's no point in doing your pulse, by the way, at that stage. You know, you've now already had a dose, so you're not going to see subtle things like that. But at least you've had a second exposure to the food. Watch yourself in the evening, and if you go to bed, nothing's happened. You're justified in assuming that's a safe food, unless you wake up feeling really bad in the morning. Assume it's a safe food and go on to the next one, okay? So that's an easy scenario. Nothing happened. The one where, you know, you feel really ill and get bad pains and bad upset is also an easy one because it means it's a problem and you shouldn't eat the food. The only things that are likely to cause trouble are things that seem a bit vague and you're not sure. And my advice, depending on the severity of your illness, but, you know, if it's been really severe, or if you're doing this, for example, to battle cancer, and incidentally, there's no, in my view, no better way to pick up an anti-cancer diet than to do this program, because it means you're picking low-immune foods, low-immune stressor foods, the very best thing you can do. So depending on how serious it is for you, you might want to be really careful, and if a food's doubtful, leave it aside and then test again. But if you followed everything I said, you'll know that you have to leave it aside for at least 4 and preferably 5 days. There's no point in saying, I'll try that one again tomorrow. Because if it is a masked allergy or has been masked or hidden, then it will go back to that state because you've just eaten some. And again, I'm sure if you follow the general theory, you'll understand that. Okay, so there are those three responses. It's very bad and clear. It's very, there is no problem and it's very clear. Although there are suspicious ones, which I would encourage you, especially if you're facing a serious health condition, to set aside and try again. Okay? What you do then is go on to the next food. The next day, if you didn't have symptoms, you go on to the next food, and you do exactly the same thing with another food. If you did have symptoms, there are some difficulties here. You know, if you found a food that provokes a reaction, that's good news, that's what you're looking for, but you're now stuck until the symptom clears. let's say you're investigating causes of diarrhea, for the sake of argument, and the food you ate gives you diarrhea, well, you're going to have to wait till all that settles down in order to properly test the next food. Otherwise, it's not a reasonable test. You've already got symptoms, do you see? There are ways to speed up that clearing reaction, and one of the best is a laxative. If you if you have any degree of stubbornness of the bowel, just take the laxative, like I said, Epsom salts or Cenapod. But we also use what's called alkali salts. Now, you can actually get these on the web. I used to have them made up in my office years ago, and we just gave them out to the patients. But here, of course, I'm not in that position, and so you have to find your own. But I did Google and found out lots of people sell it. And it's not expensive. It's basically two parts of sodium bicarbonate to one part of potassium bicarbonate. It's better that way. But if you get stuck, just use the sodium bicarbonate. What we find is that if you use litmus test on the saliva, we find that if a person has a strong allergic reaction, they go quite acidic. And if you alkalize them, then they balance up again. This has got nothing to do with acid and alkali foods. Okay, this just has to do with the physiology of stress. The acidification is associated with the symptoms, and if you can balance up again with an alkali so that the person is back to a normal pH, that generally signals the absence of the symptoms too. The point is, whenever the symptoms clear, then you go on to the next food. If you're lucky, even if you have a symptom, if you're lucky, it's gone by bedtime. The next day you wake up without symptoms, so you can do the next food anyway. But be prepared. Now, people often ask me things like, should I test with organic food? Well, the answer is yes, if you can get it, and it's a good idea if you can do it. But it isn't mandatory. If you don't normally eat organic apples, say, you just eat supermarket apples, well, test the supermarket apple. It's going to be loaded with chemicals. You can actually break it down to the next stage if you want. Say you reacted to that and you were disappointed because you like apples. Then after a few days, you can do a test again with an organic apple and see if it really was the apple or whether it's the chemicals and junk associated with the fruit. You do need to understand how much these things are messed about with by food retailers and food manufacturers and agricultural business people. Apples, for example, are sprayed with wax, but the pesticides and pollutants, you wouldn't believe what's done. A green leaf like lettuce or cabbage is sprayed between 30 and 40 times before it's harvested for the market. And these chemicals can present a serious health risk. But it's not the same thing as allergy, and it's not really necessarily what we're looking for at all. Usually the reaction, remember I mentioned I did a kind of skin testing, we always used organic foods and still saw severe reactions to plain foods like cabbage, lettuce, chicken, tomatoes and so on. It was actually the food we were using for extremely organic supplies for those tests. So all this is really not about chemical pollution, it's about foodstuffs. But, if you can get an organic supply easily for a particular thing you want to test, then it would make sense because you get both answers at the same time. If it's bad, then it's going to be bad with or without chemicals. but don't let it hold you back. That's what I teach people. If there's difficulty obtaining supplies or money's an issue, you can't afford the extra expense of organic, don't worry. Just go ahead and do the tests anyway. And then you work through your list of foods. As I said, the exclusion diet, you're giving up maybe 20 foods, a couple of dozen foods. Even if you feel great, it doesn't mean that they're all a problem. So, don't feel that because you feel well on an extreme diet, that means you're stuck with it. Not so. But it does mean you should find out what the culprits are. And it's usually one or two or maybe three foods. It's not going to be all 20, and it's unlikely to be more than half. In the majority of cases, it's one or two. And when you know what those are, you just avoid those, eat all the rest, and even the ones you have to avoid, you find substitutes. So pretty soon, you're back to a reasonably normal sort of diet. It's not extreme. You may have heard stories of people following very peculiar and extreme diets, but those are either ill-advised or just simply short-term. It tends to happen most, I think, when people do self-medicating. They've read a book and they understand these allergies and they work something out, and from then on and forever afterwards they're completely terrified to eat that food and won't ever touch it again. That isn't necessary. The mechanism that we call cyclical allergies means that usually, if you stay off the food a while, it will settle down and become less of a problem. And you can go back to eating it once in a while, you know, not very much at a time and not very often. But at least you can have it. You know, it's better than not having any at all. And you'll find probably if you just have the occasional one dose that you get away with it without symptoms. Or, you know, maybe there's symptoms, but you figure it's worth it. You know, you really want to have a bowl of ice cream and put up with a stomach ache, that's up to you. But don't mix that up with the investigative stage, okay? I have to make this clear over and over to people that the exclusion diet and the tests are narrow, they're challenging, they're difficult, you've got to be strict. And then once you've got the answers, then there's the long-term thing, staying well, which is generally easygoing, down to just mild inconvenience and just one or two foods that you need to be alert to. If you've read the book, I don't know how many people who tune in actually have read the book, but you'll notice there that I gave that there's a little panel about animal behavior. And if you've got a pet, you'll know that often they will smell and sniff and lick food and often decide not to eat it. If they don't like, you know, it doesn't taste good, it's not right for them, they won't do it. We humans are a bit crazy and we often go ahead and eat foods even though we know repeatedly that we feel sick or yucky afterwards, and then are surprised when we have to pay the consequences. Well, one of the things that you'll find going through this step is, if nothing else, you'll be given a shocking lesson in just how bad food can be. And it's usually fairly memorable. You know, it's a good lesson. It teaches you something valuable. You wouldn't want to be too careless about eating these foods if they really knock your head off when you eat them. Okay, now that's the excuse me. That's the very easy scenario. There are one or two less easy scenarios. First of all, there's the situation where you did feel good, but you don't find anything when you're trying to test foods, or it becomes very confused and muddled. And this often happens when a person is experiencing what we call delayed hypersensitivity. Just like its name sounds, it means you don't react right away. You know, you can eat the food and maybe it's 3 or 4 days later before you feel bad. You know, which will confuse you. You ate it on day one and you seemed okay, so day two you ate another food. Day three you introduced another food. Day four you introduced another food. And by day five you're sick. And you think, you know, what could it be? It could be any of those, but it might even be the one on the first day if there's a build-up. Because, you see, when a food's passed, you are allowed to eat it again. You know, if it passes the test, it's okay. Then you can eat it, I won't say as often as you want, because going back to eating the same food 2 or 3 times a day is just asking for trouble. But there are no restrictions, do you know what I mean? So you could get a build-up of a food without you being aware of it. So if it does all bog down in a complete model, you must bear this phenomenon in mind and think maybe it's that. You go back to the exclusion, you feel good again, and then what you have to do is introduce things much more slowly. So you maybe eat it for 2 or even 3 days solidly before you really decide it's safe, and then go on the next food and eat that for 2 or 3 days solidly before you decide it's safe. Or, you know, that eventually you see a build-up on this food, and so you know that's the culprit and you can avoid it. It's unfortunate to have to do it that way, and it's not very common, but, you know, if it applies to you, for goodness sake, be sensible and just be patient just that extra week or two and do it the way I've suggested, because they're just as bad. You know, the slow food build-up reactions are just as bad as the quick and nasty ones. It's a slightly different mechanism. We don't need to be technical about it, but it's still the true food allergy. And in fact, if you're interested, it relates to the same mechanism that blood group incompatibility works on, serum sickness, it's called. So if you encounter that, that's what you do. You just have to be more patient. You've always got, you see, once you've done the exclusion diet and felt good, you've always got that as a datum. So however muddled you get, if it has gone wrong and you're muddled or the symptoms are back and you don't know, just go back to the diet. That's your datum. Recover again and then try investigating again either differently or in a different sequence. But every time it messes up, you can always go back to the safe place. Okay? Now, the next scenario is what's going to happen if you feel worse when you follow the exclusion program. It's not as gloomy as it might seem at first. For one thing, it's telling you that it's definitely a food, and it's also a food you're eating more of, so that's useful. If you keep a food diary, and you should, You should keep a food diary through this process and write down your symptoms at the first moment you're aware of them, and write down everything that you eat at the time, you know, with a note of the time when you ate it. That's important because, you know, if you have a meal at 12 o'clock and you had symptoms at 11 o'clock, it can't be anything to do with that meal. But if you had the meal at 12 o'clock and the symptoms are there at 12:15, it could be. So, you know, if you keep an accurate food diary, it'll give you quite a lot of guidance. And if you're keeping one, then just look through, see what are you eating more of. And those are the first ones to suspect. Now, to test them, you're going to have to avoid them too. So in order to do that, you need to, I think, improve the diet a little. You know, rather than just going even fewer foods to eat, it's better to bring in a few probably okay foods. Like I mentioned, millet, for example. Millet and rice are relatively rare, and rice cakes make a reasonable substitute for bread. Don't go after the wheat products, but try maybe rice and rice cakes and rice milk. That will cheer the diet up quite significantly. And then, you know, when you've got a few of those kind of innocuous foods in, then give up the foods that you've been consuming more of. And usually at that point, 9 times out of 10, at that point you'll go to a good place where the symptoms clear. And then, of course, you won't forget, will you, to wait 4 days and then bring back one at a time, bring back those foods that you were eating more of. Again, doing the most likely ones last. So, you know, never rush at what you think the problem is. You have to be prepared to be surprised. Sometimes the person is quite certain they know what it is. I had a patient who used to get terrible headaches after the afternoon happy hour kind of thing, you know, a glass of scotch or something like that. He used to get headaches, and obviously he came to believe it was the scotch. Well, I tell you, it wasn't. It was the peanuts. They would have a scotch and peanuts, and it was the peanuts that was making them ill, not the scotch. So you can't jump to too many conclusions. But generally, if you follow common sense, you won't steer too far off the path and you get the answers that you're looking for. Now, another catch, while you're doing this challenge process, I mentioned, I think it was in the first or maybe the second reading room session, where it had to do with combinations of things, threshold values, where you have to reach a certain threshold to get a symptom. And maybe one or two foods on their own don't seem to do it, but when they come in combination, they do. That can be, I hope you can't hear this, there's a very noisy jet just taking off from Palm Springs Airport. Just give me a moment. Okay, good. I forgot what I was saying now. Derailed my thoughts. Okay, I have lost it for the moment. It will come back, of course, at an appropriate time, I'm sure. Oh, yes, that's right. I was talking about threshold and build-ups. You need to be alert to that, too, that sometimes when you're reintroducing things, they all seem okay, but then a symptom will come on you at some stage. If you're keeping your food diary, what you're doing is looking for reintroduced foods that have showed up in combination. And those are the ones to separate out and then try and rerun them again. I'm trying to cover every eventuality. I don't want you to think it's mostly difficult like this. I'm just trying to cover every possibility. And if you're not feeling well on the diet, you know, that's the third option, nothing really happens. First of all, do not assume it wasn't a food, because it could be. But you're going to have to approach it in different ways. And there are other possible ranges of, for example, on this diet, it's a caveman diet, we eat meat. But some people are allergic to meat. It's not so common, but it's some people are. So if you're reacting to pork or beef, you might find yourself struggling on a program like this. So one of the options you've got is to try a vegetarian approach. See if a meat-free diet helps you. It's very important if you try that you sort out the wheat and the dairy first, because you know vegetarians lean very heavily on dairy produce and the grains or cereal family. They have to. So you don't want to be switched to vegetarian and overeating those if they're bad for you, so make sure that they're okay. There are some other things that you can check for. For example, the nightshade family of foods, you've heard me mention them. I think it's a lot of people seem to know about those these days, which is great. From the deadly nightshade family, so it's a poisonous family, but it includes everyday foods like potato and tomato, chili, eggplant, peppers. Those are all in that family. So you could try a nightshade-free program. I would say that's particularly significant for skin rashes and for arthritis. These are clearly inflammatory conditions, and this group of foods seem to occur quite commonly, and in fact, I think I've commented before, certainly I commented in the book anyway, that potato shows up an awful lot of times for eczema, you know, way more than just the usual distribution. So that's worth bearing in mind. And it's surprising, actually, how many people who've got skin problems will report that if they peel potatoes, their skin either itches or is very sore and burns. And until they've been questioned like this, they never really thought about it. But if, you know, if it's so bad it burns your skin when you peel it, you shouldn't surely swallow the food, should you? Okay, now another kind of exclusion you could try is what we call nut and pip-free. There are people who have what we call a betula allergen. Betula is the scientific name for the birch tree. But this particular allergen runs right through a whole range of foods. Plants and particularly trees, but things with nuts and pips type foods. Things like almonds, apple, apricot, carrot and celery, coriander, fennel, hazelnut, kiwi. They're all listed in the book. I'm not going to try and teach you all of these here. But it's quite a range of foods. So, again, you'd have to follow my caveat to try and build up your diet a bit first. You can't, you know, miss out all the farmer foods and go Stone Age, and then miss out all the meats as well, and then miss out all the nightshades as well. You'd end up with nothing to eat. And you might think, well, that's okay, I'm tough. But, you know, it's not the point. You have to understand the principle that if you overeat any food, that it starts to develop reactions. So if you just cut down to a few foods, those foods are not going to stay safe for very long because, you know, by nature, you're just going to over-consume these foods. And that's the difficult trap I found a lot of people in, you know, that had been trying to self-help and or misguided help from practitioners that didn't really understand the full story, would end up coming to see me on pathetic diets. They'd be two or three and about 20, 30 pounds underweight and really struggling. And the game there was not so much looking for food allergies, but looking for safe foods for the first 3 months. You know, trying to build up so that it had a better repertoire. So don't go that way, that's what I'm saying. There are one or two other rather oddball exclusions you could try, I gave in the book. But gluten-free is not an oddball. That's one you may commonly have heard of. The figures are changing on that all the time, and certainly 7 to 10% of the population have gluten sensitivity. That's official. But figures are coming out now. It could be much higher than that, maybe as much as 50% of people have some degree of sensitivity here in the U.S., I'm waiting to see proper confirmation of those figures that I got, but certainly I do agree it's getting worse. And the reason is people are, you know, eating lots of those foods. Wheat is the main gluten food. The other three are oats, rye, and barley. But mostly people eat wheat rather than those other three. And because they eat so much wheat, it turns up in muffins and cakes, biscuits, pastry, pasta, cookies, pizza. Then there's a very strong exposure to gluten. And remember what I just said, the more you expose yourself to it, the more likely you are to develop a reaction. Another interesting diet is what we call a salicylate-free. Salicylic acid is aspirin. And some people get very sensitized to this. And unfortunately, a lot of foods contain aspirin-like compounds. Not surprising, because aspirin or salicylic acid comes from a plant. In fact, salix is the Latin word for willow. And salicylic acid comes from willow bark. The whole history of that is that herbalists and folk remedy people centuries ago realized that if you soak willow bark, it would bring down your temperature and ease pain. So they just used willow bark. We later found that the active part of that is a compound that's been called salicylic acid after salix, the willow. So there you go. And there are salicylate compounds in lots of food. I mean, I'll give you some examples. Apples, apricots, pears, oranges, grapefruit, lemon, strawberry, raspberry, pineapple, avocados, grapes, lychee. I could go on and on, right? There's quite a few of those. You certainly need a list to steer yourself out of trouble. There's no point in, you know, staying off 99% of those foods and then, you know, taking tea, say black tea or something like that, which has it in too, or eating Brazil nuts because you think they're safe. They're not. So you have to be very strict on that one. It's one to bear in mind. The only other one that really is perhaps big enough to be worth consideration on its own is what we call a yeast-free or mold-free diet. That's another whole story, and I'll probably be able to get to that as part of the reading room. If not, I should do a teleseminar anyway, I guess, because it's a big subject that's often, you know, little understood or badly understood. But people who are supposed to have candida, some do, some don't, but it's often called candida. But what's characteristic is the person is sensitive to mold in the environment. So moldy and damp spaces upset them, but mold foods like cheese and fungus like mushrooms are all in that family. That's another one to consider. And especially if you have one, there are three symptoms that are quite outstanding. One of them is an alcohol intolerance. Another one is a sweet tooth. And the third is a sensitivity to chemicals. If you're aware that chemical smells and perfumes, aftershave and things like that make you sick, it's something to suspect. That's what I used to call the terrible trio, those three symptoms. I later switched it to call it the awesome foursome, and the fourth symptom being abdominal bloating. That's also pretty characteristic. So if you get stuck, think of that as a possibility. On the Stone Age diet, you won't be eating many yeast or mold foods because you won't be eating cheese and bread and things like that. But it could come at you as, you know, as mushrooms and fungus. You might be advised to avoid those. Okay, so that's how you go about coming off the exclusion stage. If you were doing it from a fast, by the way, I do need to alter the advice slightly. I'd encourage you not to do a fast, but if you really must, it's certainly a quick answer, you know, if you're impatient. But you've got to come off it quicker than just one food a day. You try and work in three foods a day. You do the same thing. Take your pulse before and afterwards, your resting pulse before and afterwards, and eat a substantial helping of the food. And if it's okay, you treat it as safe and continue to eat it. And you build these foods up cumulatively. So let's say the first thing you try is, fish, say salmon. And you do this on the first morning you're going to introduce it, you do the salmon test first, and it passes. Well, the next meal, the midday meal, you can include salmon plus another new food. Kale or something like that. And that's okay. So then you've got two safe foods. So for the evening meal, you can do salmon and kale and a third new food. Do you see how that's going? That's the difference between that. Just so that you can build up quickly. What you want is, and again, absolutely important, is stay away from any possible suspect. Just eat things that seem to you most unlikely to be the trouble. Safe, healthy, and unusual foods that you don't eat much anyway. Because when you're coming off a fast, it's a bit of a disaster to have to wait three more days till a symptom clears. What you want to do is build yourself up a repertoire of safe foods first before you come on to the bad ones. Okay, so we'll assume that you've done all of this, that you've done it successfully. Either you were better or worse, but one way or the other, you've managed to figure out what the foods are. And by avoiding those, this is the acid test, you see, at the end of the day, at the end of this, two or three week period it might be to work through this. At the end of that, you want to be well on 98% well, and you want to know what to avoid. If you've been lucky and you've done a good job, it should be as simple as that. You've got two or three foods to avoid, and you avoid those, and you feel pretty good. Your only issue then is how to stay well in the long term. And I think I'll probably deal with that in a later section, really, because maintenance is a bit different to the investigative part. And I'd rather, I think, leave it for another day. But maybe I should talk about how we do this kind of approach with unusual groups. There are unusual types of patients, and some obvious ones, for example, would be people who've got diabetes that can't afford not to eat certain types of food. People who've with eating disorders, I think it's too risky to trigger them, you know, trigger strange food compulsions and psychological damage by doing this kind of approach. People who've been schizophrenic or suicidal, in other words, strongly dysfunctional, mentally dysfunctional people. Not a good idea, because a person can get an extreme reaction, and it's not unusual, it's not unheard of, I should say, it's pretty unusual, but not unheard of for a person to go extremely suicidal after eating a challenge food. So anyone that's already at risk for that, it would clearly not be a good idea. But the other big group are our children, and, you know, we have to face the fact that children suffer from these reactions, and in fact often more than adults, but certainly commonly. and they deserve their fair shot at this too. So I thought we'd probably be better served by, you know, covering this topic in relation to children, and we'll do long-term maintenance next. The important thing is that children are dependent on adults, and that's really where the problem comes from. If the child is unlucky and has an unsympathetic adult, of course, then they're not going to make it out of this trap. If mother can't be bothered changing how she's cooking the food, or, you know, the mother and father are estranged, and every time father's back home, he doesn't follow any of the rules and give the child all the banned foods anyway, it can become very difficult. So, you know, we do hope that the child is cherished and loved, and that both parents will make some effort to take the child through this program. And really, any child who's sick deserves a crack at it, because it's amazing how many, even severe chronic illnesses. I travel now with a slideshow which I call Surprising Ways That Foods Can Really Hurt You. And there are some extraordinary cases. And one of them is a boy who had muscular dystrophy, and that went into remission. Now, muscular dystrophy is a severely, you know, fatal condition, the Duchenne type. It comes on usually male children when they're about six, and they just get weaker and weaker, and all their muscles don't perform until they can't even draw breath in the end. It's like paralysis. They can't breathe properly, and they're usually dead by the age of 12. We managed to switch this off just changing the kid's diet. So I would say any kind of illness is worth considering. It's not a saying, or letting a pediatrician telling you that's ridiculous. It's a genetically inherited disease. All that story is history now anyway, you know, genetically inherited. We now know all this belief that everything is regulated by DNA and genes is really just a myth. And we now understand that genes can be switched on and off. And it's recognized. I mean, there's still some diehard scientists, but those that are aware and interested actually deal with it. And it's a subject, it's called epigenetics, meaning genetics over and above the genes. So it's not just what the genes are, but it's what happens to them. Do they express themselves, or do they not express themselves? And by doing this diet program, you can switch off bad genes, trust me, no matter how bad. And you can switch on bad genes if you do it wrong. You can switch on good genes if you do it right. So it's well worth the effort. And for children, it can be the difference between life and death. So, you know, never swallow a story. It's hopeless and you can't do anything. All of health is an expression of overload. If you're simply overloaded with too many factors, and genetics is only one of the factors that a person has to deal with. All the other things that are environmental, like chemicals and diet and psychology, all these other stresses and overloads in our environment all play their part, as well as the genes. It is very narrow thinking, very dumb, very stupid, I believe, for my colleagues to think that genetics is it. If you've got the gene, forget it. There's nothing you can do. It's just silly. It just doesn't fit the facts. So, you know, why not? If a child has a condition, give it a shot. And for all the obvious things, like behavioral disorders, skin rashes, asthma, always worth a shot. 85% of asthma cases, in my experience, were food. Everyone thinks of, you know, dust and cat fur. And sure enough, you know, a lot of asthmatics are allergic to dust, and it's a big problem. But it isn't the only problem. You know, if a person is allergic to cat fur, they live with a cat. It's amazing how many people have asthma and still insist on having pets in the home. But anyway, they may be allergic to, say, cat fur, but also milk. Well, they don't want to get rid of the cat. They're attached to it, so why not give up the milk? And that's usually enough. That may itself be enough to switch off the symptom. So there are many conditions where you'd think of investigating it. I'm saying think of pretty well everything. You know, about the only thing where food allergy has little or no relevance would be something like a broken leg, you know. Almost everything else, give it a shot. There are certain things that you'd look for in a child. Remember, a child is not always able to express themselves very subjectively in terms of the symptoms from which they're suffering. All you may be aware of is the child is, you know, moody and badly behaved, and you know, maybe doesn't seem to be that bright. You know, they don't study so well, they're not making it, and you may not see anything more than that unless you specifically look for it. If you question the child, they're not aware of anything. They're too sulky to give you answers like, you know, I don't feel very good about this or something like that. But one of the strongest clues I ever found over the years was a child who's a picky eater. I don't know if you use that term here, but what we mean by a picky eater is they pick at their food. They won't. They're very fussy. What they, you know, they won't eat this. No, I don't want this. I'm not eating this. Nyeh, nyeh, sort of attitude. But they'll eat that. You know, yes, I'll have some of that. But then they only pick at it anyway. It's very difficult to get them to eat. You know, you put down a plate of food and they take a few bits from it and you say, come on, eat your food. You know, you need to grow up. No, 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 I don't want to. So those of you who have been parents would recognize that kind of child. That picky eating is almost characteristic of food allergy. And 99.9% of the time, what I observed happened is that when you went through the program, found the culprit foods and removed them, there was a complete transformation. He or she would sit down to a huge plate of food, tuck in with a knife and fork and eat a lot. They really had a hearty appetite, but the pickiness was itself a symptom. Beware of a child that's got so-called growing pains. You know, there's no such thing as growing pains. It's sort of nonsense that growing causes pain. But there are aches and pains that are very common during the growth process. Milk allergy is probably the number one cause for that, but anything else can do that. So you need to be alert to that. So-called growing pains, particularly in the formative years, think of a food reaction primarily. If the child is having abnormal moods and behavior, as we're saying, they're moody or they cry, that's quite typical. You know, they get into spats. Smashing up attacks is one version of that. And it's extraordinary how violent and strong kids can be when there's a rage. You know, it's more than just smashing a few toys. They can, you know, damage furniture and wreck the home. They really can produce extraordinary bursts of energy when they're being triggered by this. Something else pretty characteristic to look for is what we call the allergic facies. Facies means, you know, the appearance of the face. It's just a Latin version of the same thing. But you can see it in their face, and very typically, and this is something, you know, with a trained eye like mine, you can see it at 600 feet, right? The person is very pale. They have dark rings under their eyes. We call them allergic shiners, in fact. A shiner is a slang name, as you know, for a black eye. They often have sparkling, glittery eyes, though. They're very bright children, and there's sometimes you see the presence also of what we call the allergic salute. The child has a runny, catarrhy, snotty nose, and they keep shoving their nose up with their fingers and sniffing like that. And they do it so often that even some children have a crease across their nose where it's been pushed up so often it creases, and you can actually diagnose the condition from the crease. So you can see that in the face of a child who's suffering this kind of phenomenon. And again, it reverses, you know, you fix the diet, you take them off the foods, and you see that nice general pink complexion comes back, and they look healthy, that pasty, sickly look disappears. So it's all very satisfying when you do this with kiddies. But I also want you to think of food when you've got recurring respiratory infections, like recurring ear infections, upper respiratory infections, chest infections, especially in the very young, you know, the 6 months, 9 months, 18 months, 2 years, that sort of area, where repeated raging sore throats and ear infections are quite common. And doctors, you generally don't think any further than, oh, it's here again, some more penicillin, and they never look behind it to think what might be there. So often it's milk allergy. It's not confined to milk allergy. It can be corn and other things, but milk is a very common offender here. Milk, you may know, is notorious for, well, adults say it thickens the catarrh. What they mean is it produces a catarrhal reaction. That's an ear, nose, and throat reaction. And it's an inflammatory process, so it's not unlikely that would lead to ear trouble, because you probably know there's a little tube drains down from the ear into the back of the throat. So if you get inflammation in the back of the throat, it very easily travels to the ear. All I'm saying is the inflammation is very often not started by a bacteria. It's started by milk or an allergen. The bacteria simply, you know, cash in on the situation. The only other thing to alert you to is an excitable child. We know, heard this term now, ADD or ADHD. We used to just call the kids hyperactive, but there is attention deficit certainly, as well as hyperactivity disorder. Quite classic, and it's really foods working like a revving up stimulus rather than a tranquilizing or slowing down stimulus. So any of those things that make you, these are objective things, you know, you don't have to ask the child if you see this. Oh, and one other, I mustn't miss out, and that's bedwetting. Bedwetting has many reasons, and certainly if it persists, it's going to be accompanied by quite a strong psychological disturbance. The child gets very upset about it and eventually gets very neurotic about it. But, you know, that's usually secondary, not primary. It doesn't cause the problem. It's because of the problem. And recurring bedwetting can be a sign of food allergy and intolerance. So do bear that in mind. Okay. Now, if we're going to investigate a child, what do we do that's different? Well, one of the first things I do that's different is making it a little bit easier for them. I usually allow rice cakes. I don't know if you're familiar with this food, but it's like puffed corn. But they puff the rice in a metal case, so when everything explodes, it blasts itself into a shape rather like a circular or square biscuit or cookies. They're like a cookie, but not sweet. So a biscuit, I suppose, is the better word. It looks like polystyrene roof tiles and tastes just about the same. But it's pretty innocuous. Very few children ever turn out, even Chinese and Asian children, ever turn out to be sensitive to rice. So it's an option. You can also get dairy-free margarine. Normally, I wouldn't recommend margarine for anybody. It's trans fats and all that nonsense. But you're not going to cause damage over the space of just a week or two. And it can often be more pleasurable for the child if they have rice cakes with a kind of spread. And you can use various jams or honey even, providing it's pure. When I say jam, you know jam is a sugar conserve. That's what stops the mold and bacteria growing in the jam, is such strong sugar that it dehydrates the organisms and they can't grow. So you don't want that. What you want are what we call whole earth jams. And you can get them at Whole Foods. In fact, I've even seen them in Albertsons or Ralph's, can't remember which. There's a brand called Mammon, a French brand. But these don't have sugar. What it relies on is that you keep it in the refrigerator. That's the way to stop the fungus and bacteria growing on it. That would be acceptable for a child, and that makes a big difference. Plus, there are one or two little recipes in there, little treats for kids. Some of them, you know, it's like a cooking recipe. You'd have to go to the book for making things like, peanut butter squares. But the banana treat there is a great one. That's always been a big hit in our household. Slice a banana lengthways, put peanut butter down the middle. Pure peanut butter without additives. So it's like a sandwich, you know, banana sandwich with peanut butter in the middle. And you drizzle either honey or maple syrup on the top and scatter it with sesame seeds. Wonderful. And that makes a child feel that they're not being exposed to something very extreme. Nevertheless, it's not normal eating, and a child may feel, you know, they're being treated abnormally or maybe even punished if you're not careful. So if there are siblings, I do advise you to get the whole family and the siblings to cooperate and accompany the sick child. And it's really very good if the parents do it too. It's not only good for the child, it's good for the parents. To begin with, it helps them know what the child is going through. But, you know, I always say this to the parents too. Look, you know, if your child has got allergies, there's a good chance you have. So you might just drop lucky and find something that's very beneficial to you as well. And I've had many parents that way find out they were allergic to wheat or corn or something like that just by accompanying the child. So it can be worthwhile for everybody. And, you know, generally, kids are very good. Once they understand what you're doing and why, and they're resigned to it, they will follow the advice. Everyone is so used to thinking of this, you know, this is a naughty child. This child definitely won't cooperate on a diet. You know, I know he's going to cheat. But it's not true. If you take them off the trigger foods, then they stop the funny food behaviors. I mean, I can remember a child who used to come down in the night and would eat a bowl of sugar in the night. You know, the parents were baffled for some time until they caught him in the act. Whole bowls full of sugar vanish in the night and gone by breakfast time. It was a kiddie coming down to do that. Well, he stopped on the diet simply because he didn't have any triggers to go and do that, and he didn't really have that much of a sweet tooth once the triggers were taken away. Okay, so, and the other thing you've got to watch is not, parents are not usually the problem, it's other members of the family, like grandmothers and grandfathers. And they're often quite naughty and try and buy themselves some kudos points with the child by saying, oh, come on, have a piece of chocolate or a candy. It'll be okay. Don't worry. Shh, we won't tell anybody. That sort of thing is very damaging. It's damaging to the integrity of the whole thing, but also the child. The child is generally more responsible than that adult, and will often tell the adult, no, I'm not supposed to have chocolate. You know what mummy said, which surprises the older adult, aunties and uncles. You know, it's adults anyway. That's what I'm saying. The pressure is likely to come from adults rather than peers. Now, if the child is going to school, you're going to have to make some provision. The child is going to have to take a diet. with them. There's no way you can eat school junk food. And I mean, it's serious garbage that they serve at school these days. By the way, if you've not heard of the Appleton school experiment, that's the apple, the fruit with T-O-N on the end, Appleton, in Wisconsin, go and Google it and read it. It's very inspiring. A child where behaviors were deplorable. But by changing the diet, kids' behavior utterly transformed. Their grades shot up. The violence disappeared, and I mean violence. They had a permanent armed police officer on standby at the school because there were often firearms offenses and extreme violence. All that disappeared just by changing diet. So it's well worth reading Appleton's school experiment. And they served simply very good food in the food in the school canteen. That was the only change they made. But you know, most schools don't even want to learn from this this objective precedent. You know, then they're not interested. They just want to make the profit on the sodas and the candies and all the garbage that they sell. Quite wicked and irresponsible, in my view. But still, that's the way it is. So, and if all else fails, if you can't get cooperation at school, just keep the child at home. It's a health issue, and you just write them a note saying he's not well, he's not going to school because it is a health issue. Period. And that way, you can usually control more exactly what's happening. But the rewards, you know, for doing this are great. Kids' grades will often soar, as I said. If a person is really suffering from a brain that kind of feels like it's pushed back in sideways on, you know, it's hard to learn things. It's hard to even concentrate on things. The mind learn things. But once you stop the process, then a person can learn. And quite rightly, a lot of these kids turn out to be very bright. And I explain that to patients, to parents. The neural tube is folded in from the skin in embryology. It sort of folds itself up, and it's started from similar ectodermal tissue. That's the outside skin-type tissue. So the brain tissue is very like the skin. So if you've got these kids with atopic allergy disease, you know, fiery eczema and red rashes that come and go, and asthma, that's called an atopic condition. Very often associates with extremely excitable neurological tissue as well. So they're in line for ADD and ADHD. But because it's excitable brain tissue, it means they're often very bright, you know, extremely bright. But they're not being given their fair chance because nobody's really understood what the problem is. So if you, you know, if you have the care of children, you have your own children, or your family has children or in any way are suffering, always bring this to their attention, that it's something that's well worth doing with a kiddie. The transformations are utterly wonderful. From a child that's a handful and the parents tearing their hair out, and therefore, you know, they run out of temperature, they run out of temper and become, you know, abusive and hurtful to the child. They get irritated and short-tempered. All of this is all understandable, but, you know, it's not good for the child. So when all that transforms, the love can reassert itself and the conditions in the family transform. It's amazingly satisfying sometimes. And I've seen kids brought back from the most extreme of conditions, like deep autism, where they're completely out of communication with anything and anybody, antisocial and smashing up the place, absolute candidates for special schools, if not, you know, a prison in later life, all coming good. So, you know, worth the effort. Now, I might mention just before I close then that the Feingold diet in that section, this was a big diet that arose in the 1980s, became a big thing because Ben Feingold was a regular physician, so therefore, you know, it must be right. I mean, what I was saying couldn't be true because I wasn't holding a hospital appointment. He did, so he must be right and me wrong. That sort of mentality, you know, it didn't stop any of my patients, but a lot of patients went the conventional route, or route, as you say, through hospital. And so they got introduced to this diet because ordinary pediatricians were willing to consider it. Most of them still thought food had nothing to do with a child's behavior. But a few did, and they followed Feingold's lead. And Feingold was actually mistaken. He got some very good results, so it's worth mentioning. You know, his belief was that it was all to do with colorings and chemicals in food, and then after a while he broadened that to thinking, well, it's not just that, it's the salicylates as well. But he was never willing to consider that, you know, milk is much commoner than all those reactants. Corn is much commoner, egg is much commoner. Kiddies do react to food colorings and preservatives, but they react much more to pure, quality, whole foods. And that's been the true story. All the way through, you know, most people, when you say, certainly in the 80s anyway, you said food allergy, most people thought, oh yes, junk food. I said, no, I don't mean junk food. I mean good food allergy, reacting to really decent food. It's not an issue of junk food and chemical additives and preservatives and so on. Okay, let me. I'm going to open up for questions in a minute, but it's just worth tagging on the end. If for those of you who have not read the book, you should get it, because one of the great and very interesting sections is I've just shared some of my experiences with on the subject of pregnancy and unborn babies. You believe it or not, you can actually have allergic or food intolerance reactions to babies in the womb. And mother, once alerted to this, mother then becomes aware of it, and she realizes that every time she eats a certain food that the baby starts kicking like crazy. In other words, it becomes hyperactive. So it's possible to even diagnose before the child is born that it reacts to certain kinds of food. More to the point, in my view, it's important for mothers to actually restrict their own diet while they're pregnant. They shouldn't eat junk food, corn, sugar, dairy products, and all these things, because the chances of sensitizing the child are very high. And I've been saying this for 30 years, but I'm very pleased to see that this has now gone into conventional teaching, and that all the regular doctors now are saying the same kind of thing. If the child is at risk for allergy, I mean, that's their caveat, you know. They'll only consider it if they see some outrageous condition like hay fever or eczema or asthma, whereas, you know, I considered it for everything, of course. But nevertheless, they're on the right lines, and they're saying, you know, if there's a risk here, then the mother should probably exclude milk from her diet during the pregnancy. And very good, too, because it means that the child is much less likely to get sensitized. When the child is newborn, best to be breastfed, and again, what the mother's eating is critical. I've many, many times seen children react to a substance that the mother's eaten via the mother's milk. So the same restrictions really apply at that time. Until the child's immune system begins to mature, which it starts to do between 3 and 6 months, it starts to live independently. Up to that point, the child gets all its antibodies from mother via the milk. That's why breastfeeding is so important and so healthy. But eventually, the child's own immune system kicks in. And the longer you can preserve that from things like cow's milk, you know, the bad triggers like cow's milk and egg and so on, the longer you can keep it away, the better. And the teaching now has suggested maybe up to 12 months if there's a severe risk of allergy. So it's great to see pediatricians actually getting involved. One of them used to attack me relentlessly in public in Britain. I mean, I always came off best. We get on TV arguing, and I generally won. But nevertheless, he was very aggressive. Later, 15 years later, teaching the same story. So it's really odd, isn't it, the way these things go. So I've gone through that part of the program. As I said, we'll look at long-term maintenance, I think, next time. Okay, the this is from Ron Elliott in Granada Hills, not so far from here. Could the Massaro Emoto discoveries be used to alter poisoning or negative influence? Well, there's two parts to this question. Let's take that one. I don't think that quite Emoto was saying that, you know, he was saying you could alter the structures of water, but I don't think he was saying that you could really disable a poison by sticking a beautiful thought label on the side of the jar. I don't think he really said that, Ron. Anyway, if he did, I would still be inclined to say, well, you know, why take the risk? Because if it's just milk, just give up milk. It's not that difficult. Ron's gone on to say something else. I used the diet where I never ate the same foods in a four-day period. Right, okay, now this is important, and I will be introducing it next time in the long term. And by the way, I expect to be back to the normal day, Thursday next week. It may not be Thursday, but it should be, but whatever it's going to be, I will email you. So when we're back to the reading room next week, that's what I'm going to cover. And rotating foods over four-day periods can be very, very important for some people. Okay, anyone on the phone line wants to give me a verbal question?
Yeah, this is Victoria. I have a
question. Hi, Victoria, yes.
Also, if a person is like 100 pounds overweight with all the attending, you know, heart trouble, diabetes, bad knees, whatever goes with that is all there, would this be safe to? I mean, would you assume they have allergies, or how?
I would say it's very difficult to end up, you know, 200 or 300 pounds, 100 pounds and 150 pounds overweight, unless you do have some kind of food intolerance, allergic addiction mechanism. Remember, I've said before, people tend to get hooked on the very foods that do them harm, and they get into repetitive eating. And in this country, in the Western world, these are very typically cereal foods. The cereal foods are the ones that everyone overeats. Wheat and corn, that family of foods is in, it's in so many things. You know, I said before, wheat turns up in bread, cakes, cookies, pasta, pastry, pizza. And most people eat one or more of those foods at every meal, if you watch. So if they just avoided the cereal foods or the farmer foods, they would lose weight easily. And in fact, this is a great way to lose weight. I've had some lots of nice emails from people who just bought this book, and it's a short life. But I mean, over the years, I've got hundreds, thousands of cases of people who've just used it as a weight loss program. If you figure out what foods not to eat and don't eat them, you lose weight no matter how much you're eating. And it's great. You know, you can eat three or four meals a day, full meals, not feel hungry. You can fry food. My wife, for example, loves her fries now. She was always told that fries are bad. They're fatty. You mustn't eat them. You'll gain weight. She actually loses weight if she eats fries, providing she stays off the wheat and corn. And she's not unique, of course. I shouldn't keep bringing her up as an example, but she's very close to me. But, you know, if you do it right, you can lose weight comfortably, and there's no reason to be hungry. And on the exclusion diet, I said last week, if you're on the exclusion diet and you're hungry, just cook the whole meal again and eat it twice. It'll still work. And if you go on the exclusion diet, typically the person will lose 6 pounds or so in the first week. That's a lot because it's water, mostly water. Then it settles down to losing about 2 pounds a week, and that will go on month after month, all the while, you know, eating satisfying meals. You don't have to count calories. You don't have to count carbohydrates. It's easy. Just stay off the banned foods.
Okay.
Is that sufficient answer?
Yes.
If you haven't read the book yet, I think you'll know a lot more when you've read the book, and you'll really be able to apply that.
Okay, and I didn't quite understand what you said about diabetes.
Well, if a person has what we call brittle diabetes, means that, you know, your blood sugar can dive quite easily, a bit too much insulin and the person collapses, or a bit too little and the person all of a sudden finds themselves in a diabetic coma. So in other words, it's not very well controlled. They have to be very careful about the amount of carbohydrate that they eat. And this usually comes under a physician's care. But typically and stupidly, what most doctors say is eat all this extra carbohydrate, then you'll need this insulin to balance it. And the first thing I say to my patients was always, well, if you don't eat the carbohydrate, you don't need the insulin. And that was the first surprise, you know. They didn't. If you just don't eat carbohydrate, how can you get high blood sugar? Because you're not swallowing anything with sugar in it.
Mm-hmm.
So providing it's not very brittle, a person could do it for themselves. And generally speaking, if you just avoid the foods that are banned, the cereals and grain food, your blood sugar will come tumbling down and stay down. Your insulin resistance will go. Your obesity goes. It's all part of a syndrome that's called metabolic syndrome. Have you heard of that? It was called Syndrome X a few years ago. It was discovered by a doctor called Gerald Reaven. I think in 1987 he started to write about it. But it was characterized by certain stages and certain, you know, it began as obesity, went on to insulin resistance, but then included, you know, a person had diabetes, disordered sugar metabolism, insulin resistance, and blood pressure and some altered blood fats, all as a picture. So it was a syndrome. So he called it Syndrome X because he didn't know what it was. And we now call it metabolic syndrome. You may come across that. Okay. The key to getting rid of it is just simply stop eating carbohydrate. It's the whole cause of it. And I say to people, you know, when you're on the exclusion diet, you'd be astonished how sweet a carrot is. It's full of sugar. But, you know, once you start putting sugar in your tea and eating candies and cookies, a carrot is very sweet. Trust me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, you know, it's a more pleasant way to get your carbs. You know, I mean, an apple is the, well, you need a couple of apples to be the equivalent of a slice of bread, but it's a much healthier way to get your carb. But if you count your carbs, you can count it with using fruits instead of using starches and cereal. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Okay. Anyway, this is Reading Room. This is Diet Wise, not Vocal. So it's been. I've enjoyed the session today. I hope you found it useful. We'll be back to the normal time next week. You will be notified. But it'll be in the evening. I got a very kind email from a Jewish subscriber in New York who reminded me that it's, of course, Sabbath on a Saturday. So they're all out of the game when I choose Saturday. So that wasn't a good choice. Sorry about that, folks. But we'll be back to a normal weekday and a full complement, I guess. And I'll see you then. Okay, take care till then. Thanks very much.